Court calls United States v. Hutchins. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Major Babu Kaza, here today on behalf of the appellant, Sergeant Larry Hutchins. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
So granted.
The government comes before this Court and asks it to set two precedents. First, to validate as an appropriate practice the secondary political review of an ongoing military justice case where the political leadership dictates a desired outcome. And second, the government asks this Court to hold that when the suspect who's being interrogated invokes his right to counsel to terminate the interrogation, a constitutionally permissible response will be to lock him in an isolated trailer for 7 days and see if he has a change of heart and will make a statement.
Do you agree that if we decide in your favor on the first issue that we don't reach the second issue?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to talk about the second issue first because there's limited disagreement between the government and defense on some of the essential facts. Namely, there's no disagreement that there was an unequivocal invocation of counsel, that Sergeant Hutchins was in fact held in a locked trailer for 7 days after that, that he was not permitted to use available means of communication, such as the MWR phones or the U.S. mail, and he was not given any possible access to an attorney. And the government has never offered any rationale or justification for why he was held under these circumstances. Now, given these facts, the Court can assess what occurred for Issue 2, both as a question of voluntariness under totality of circumstances standard, and also under Edwards versus Arizona regarding reinitiation. Turning first to voluntariness.
Are you focusing on the second issue because you think it's you have a stronger case than the unlawful command influence issue?
No, Your Honor, simply because I believe this issue is straightforward. We can resolve it rather quickly and then spend more time on the unlawful command influence issue. For voluntariness, the standard is totality of circumstances, and as articulated in Miranda, incommunicado interrogation is psychologically coercive. Incommunicado confinement is psychologically coercive. So when you look at the totality of the circumstances, let's look first at the circumstances prior to him being put in this confinement.
Can I ask one question about factual agreement or not? You said the parties agree on the core facts. And do the parties agree on who reinitiated interrogation?
As far as the factual basis of what happened, for purposes of the appeal, there is no disagreement. As far as legally who should be considered having reinitiated, there is disagreement on that. But the fact that NCIS independently went to his trailer and began that communication, that's not in dispute. And it was after that communication that Sergeant Hutchins said that he would like to speak further. That's not in dispute as well. Now, at the trial level, what was in dispute was NCIS making further statements to Sergeant Hutchins, specifically saying he had made a mistake when he invoked his right to counsel. Now, understanding for purposes of the appeal, we don't need to revisit that factual dispute. Simply taking the facts as found by the military judge is more than enough to show, one, involuntariness, and for another, an Edwards versus Arizona violation. Again, to briefly to touch on for the voluntariness piece, the totality of the circumstances, again, he's in a war zone cut off from stable environment. He's told he's facing serious criminal charges. His request to his platoon sergeant that he be allowed to use a telephone to contact a lawyer isn't acted upon. And he's stripped of his weapon and sent through a hostile area and then separated from the Marines from the squad who represented the only stability he had. He's then subject to a combative interrogation by two NCIS agents. His request to speak to counsel is only responded to by him being placed in incommunicado confinement, where he has no social contact with anyone beyond his guards, and all of his meals are in fact brought to his trailer. It was only after the 7 days of this treatment that he finally relented when NCIS unexpectedly arrived in his trailer and spoke to him about the investigation. Now, this is something that should never happen under modern rules. Under RCMP.
Just to be clear, they then waited to question until the next day, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. The NCIS contact was on May 18, 2006, and that contact led to the May 19, 2006 statement. But simply looking at, and putting aside the Edwards issue for the moment, simply looking at these circumstances as a question of voluntariness, okay, this is a textbook Miranda violation that should never occur under our modern system. Under RCM 305, under the federal rules, there is no circumstance where you could put somebody in confinement for 7 days incommunicado and not allow them to speak to an attorney.
Was the 305 issue raised at trial?
The fact that RCM 305 was discussed at trial, Your Honor, during the
Did they move to suppress on the basis of a violation of 305?
Correct. To be suppressed that He was not given access to counsel, and that was one. And that was a voluntariness factor. That was, in fact, discussed.
But in the Edwards analysis, or in the, was there a 305?
Was there a 305 motion at trial?
There was not a 305 motion.
There was not.
There was a 305 discussion on the voluntariness piece. The joint appendix at page 344, Captain Bass discussed that with the military judge and indicated that's another factor to show that.
But in the context of Edwards.
In the context of voluntariness, Your Honor.
Are you saying that it, and this is a neutral question, I'm just trying to isolate the principle of law, that under no circumstances after that 7 days could he have voluntarily made a statement?
99% of the time, right? I could never say under no circumstances, but where there's been 7 days of incommunicado confinement, it would be very, very difficult.
The circumstance, in your view, would be only if done in the presence of counsel.
Correct.
Is that essentially what you're saying?
After there's been an opportunity to consult with counsel, as he's entitled to under the Constitution, at that point, after consultation, then he could make a knowing and voluntary decision whether or not he wanted to cooperate with NCIS. Now, turning to the Edwards issue, as discussed, the facts, as established by the military judge, are that NCIS specifically went to Sergeant Hutchins' trailer uninvited. Special Agent Connolly testified that his purpose for going to the trailer was in furtherance of his criminal investigation. And when they get to that trailer, Special Agent Connolly, the same agent who previously interrogated Sergeant Hutchins, an agent with 30 years of experience, what does he do? He tells Sergeant Hutchins orally, according to his own testimony, he tells him orally, hey, we're still investigating you for murder, conspiracy, and kidnapping. We want to search your trailer for more evidence against you. And then he shows a form in Sergeant Hutchins' face that says the exact same thing. And under Special Agent Connolly's testimony, it was while Sergeant Hutchins was reading that form that he looked up and said, okay, can I still talk some more about this investigation? Under either Rhode Island versus Innis or Oregon versus Bradshaw, this was an Edwards versus Arizona violation. Under Rhode Island versus Innis, this was an interrogation. The standard is conduct by law enforcement officers likely to, that law enforcement officers know or should know, is likely to elicit an incriminating response. When Special Agent Connolly knows that Sergeant Hutchins has asked for counsel, has been isolated for 7 days, and then approaches him again and tells him again he's being investigated for murder, he knew or should have known that was going to cause a response from Sergeant Hutchins. At a minimum, that's a violation of Oregon versus Bradshaw, which says that once there's an invocation of right to counsel, the only permissible communications are those which are incident to confinement and not directly related to the investigation. We already have Special Agent Connolly testifying that he went there for the purpose of his investigation. So under either of those standards, there was an Edwards versus Arizona violation. And under the voluntariness standard as well, the statement was improperly admitted. Now, if I could touch briefly on prejudice, I would ask this court to examine the statement Sergeant Hutchins gave with the findings of the members. If you look at those findings, every single charge and specification that was not corroborated by that statement, the members found Sergeant Hutchins not guilty of. That by itself is enough to show that the defense has more than met its burden for showing that this was not a harmless error. Turning to issue one. In November 2009, the Secretary of the Navy made a deliberate effort to inform the Marine Corps and the general public. They had personally reviewed the trial records in the 8 Hamdaniya cases. And based on his review, he was unhappy with the trial results and the lenient treatment by the military justice system. He then presented his view of the case based on his review of the records. And in his view, the combat environment was not mitigating, and Sergeant Hutchins and his squad had specifically conspired to kidnap and kill any random Iraqi that could be found. And in fact, a random Iraqi was killed as a matter of premeditated murder.
Counsel, let's
take a look at Article 37, if we could. There are two sentences in that. And your argument is that it applies, Article 37, the unlawful command influence applies because he is a convening authority. If you look at the two sentences, the first sentence talks about a convening authority cannot censure, reprimand, or admonish, blah, blah, blah. The next sentence says, no person subject to this chapter may attempt to influence the actions of a court-martial. So are there two different applications there, one on attempting to coerce members of a court-martial, which applies to convening authorities. I mean, that's what the language says. Then Congress chose to use no person subject to this chapter, different language for the second sentence. What do we make of that distinction?
So the second clause of Article 37, Your Honor, is words of expansion compared to the first clause. The first clause talks about specific ills and evils that could be caused by a commanding officer or convening committee, somebody in a certain specific position of command. Having established that, Congress then added in the second clause to have a greater application to anybody under the UCMJ. So that first clause serves to emphasize specific prohibitions that were likely to occur from commanding officers or convening authorities or people in command.
But not necessarily convening authorities in the second clause.
The second clause would, as drafted, the second clause encompasses the first clause in his words of expansion, Your Honor.
But he's not subject to the code.
He's not subject to the code under Article 2, Your Honor. However, he is given military justice authority under
That's
the
right, subject. But he's not a person subject to code under Article 2. Isn't that the normal meaning of that phrase?
Subject to the phrase subject to the code, Your
Right.
Honor? Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Beyond that, looking at the purpose behind Article 37, government cites legislative history, the purpose was to prevent command control of military justice proceedings. UCMJ was drafted by Congress to ensure fairness to service members. One of the primary concerns that Congress had was command influence, and that
okay.
could emanate.
Now, counsel, he is the appointed head of the Navy. He is the head of the Department of the Navy. He is appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate, and subject to the control of the Secretary of Defense, he's responsible for the operation of the Department of the Navy. Shouldn't we as judges be very, very chary of getting into the public statements of responsible civilian officials in a constitutional system of civilian control of the armed forces? They have to do this as part of their jobs. Now, shouldn't we be very, very cautious at getting into that as a matter of policy and as a matter of constitutional structure?
No, Your Honor. When it comes to questions of unlawful command influence on the military justice system, this Court should not be wary. One of this Court's primary responsibilities and concerns is to defend the military justice process from this very type of influence. This Court's opinions in United States versus Hagen and United States versus Simpson made very clear that there was no distinction between unlawful influence from military officials or civilian officials. What matters was that there was unlawful influence and that the process was tainted. And
who
was
okay. the unlawful influence on?
The unlawful influence, by definition from the Secretary...
Stipulating for the purpose of argument that there was unlawful influence. But who was so affected?
Everybody who was subordinate to the Secretary of the Navy, Your Honor, as a basic command relationship, and that would include the entire Navy and Marine Corps, specifically the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, the
But who in the context of the court-martial, I mean, it had to have an unfair effect on the proceedings, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
It can't just be that somebody read it, Seaman somewhere read it and said, oh, okay. So in this case, where is the some evidence that that the proceedings were in fact affected in some manner? It's a neutral question.
Yes, Your Honor.
And presumably this is after the court-martial, correct?
Yes,
you're not arguing it somehow went back. So at the point that the statements were made, moving forward, who was subject to this influence?
Statements were made in November 2009. As Your Honor mentions, the court-martial had concluded that point, and convening authority action had occurred. In November 2009, the military justice process was still ongoing. Specifically, cases under review by the judges of the Navy and Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals, so they were affected by the unlawful command influence.
They could have been. You have to put some evidence that they were, right? But okay.
Yes, Your Honor. So
I'm just looking at my menu first.
Understanding, Your Honor. So simply talking about the universe of who could have been influenced at that point, Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals, Judge Advocate General of the Navy, convening authority in the event there could be a rehearing or retrial, and as well as all those individuals designated authority under Article 74. All those individuals could, in fact, have been influenced by the Secretary of the Navy. And
why not this court?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why not this court?
This court is not subordinate to the Secretary of the
so
Navy.
So in order to have unlawful command influence, you have to be a subordinate of the person?
You do not, Your Honor. You can certainly be unlawfully influenced by anything, but at least the term unlawful command influence, as we discussed in the UCMJ and the case law, it specifically references the that type of command authority.
So you're focusing on the CCA, the TJAG, and the parole board, or no?
All those, Your Honor. Not just the parole board, all the other individuals who are designated Article 74 authority.
Okay. Now can you tell us why there's some evidence in each of those cases that they were, in fact, so influenced?
Yes, Your Honor. Starting with the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, who is a direct subordinate of the Secretary of the Navy, per Title 10 of the U.S. Code and Secretary of the Navy instruction. 6 months after Secretary Mavis made his statements, the Judge Advocate General of the Navy was faced with a favorable decision for Sergeant Hutchins by the lower court. The Judge Advocate General of the Navy, against the advice of his staff, certified that appeal to this court. That is some evidence that he was influenced.
How do you know it was against the advice of his staff?
A couple of ways, Your Honor. For one, that's a matter of public record in public news articles. And for another, the defense had those recommendations from the staff and moved to attach those to the record. And according to the lower court, they were attached to the record. So a mere 6 months after these statements...
Does that mean that any case that a TJAG certifies, he's always a subordinate? What, you presume unlawful command influence then? Anytime the TJAG certifies a case?
When there has been specific statements from his direct superior, Your Honor, about the case?
So it's statements, superior, certification.
Yes, Your Honor. So, for example, if Commanding General of the 2nd Marine Division had made some statements, I wouldn't argue that that necessarily influences the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, who wouldn't be subordinate to the Commanding General of the 2nd Marine Division. The Judge Advocate General of the Navy is subordinate to very few people. One of them is the Secretary of the Navy. That's why those individuals that have that authority at that level, such as the Secretary of the Navy, have a sacred responsibility when they're exercising their authority over the military to exercise it in a responsible fashion, such that it doesn't unlawfully influence proceedings, or at a minimum.
And in the case of the CCA, how do you address the presumption that the military judges would know the law and apply the law correctly, including the law of not being unlawfully influenced?
Specifically for unlawful command influence, the case law on military judges not being, or the case law presuming military judges would not be influenced by UCI, is dependent on the fact that military judges are independent and would generally be independent from any chain of command that could influence them. This is one of the very few circumstances where that's not the case, because the Secretary of the Navy is, in fact, superior to the judges on the lower court.
But their initial action was to reverse his conviction. I mean, how is that some evidence of unlawful command influence on that NMCCA?
The lower court was still influenced, Your Honor. The influence just simply didn't rise to the level of outweighing the error of the improper counsel severance. If you look at the lower court's opinion, look at how they describe the facts of the case and the findings of the case, and specifically looking at Judge Price's concurring opinion, which is not challenged by the majority, it indicates that the lower court saw the case the same way the Secretary of the Navy did, which was in fact contrary to the members' findings. So simply merely by fact of them reversing the case doesn't mean they weren't influenced. It just means that the influence didn't overcome that in an en banc panel.
Is your stronger argument actual command influence or the appearance of unlawful command influence?
The appearance of unlawful command influence, Your Honor, simply because that wouldn't require any further fact-finding, although certainly appellant submits there is actual unlawful command influence in this case.
Could you address in your remaining time whatever?
Which you have. You can answer the question.
Your best argument for actual command influence, or excuse me, for the appearance of unlawful command influence.
For an objective member of the public looking at what's happening in this case sees that the Secretary of the Navy makes these very public, highly disseminated statements in November 2009, very directly for the specific purpose of chastising the military justice process's handling of this case. A few months later, the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, who reports to the Secretary of the Navy, certifies a favorable decision for review by this court against the advice of his staff. That, in fact, that decision from that court that was certified, although it was favorable, that has information in it which indicates that the lower court had adopted the Secretary of the Navy's view of the case. The case goes back to the lower court for a second opinion where the lower court decides against the appellant on every single issue and doesn't address the factual inaccuracies in its first opinion and, in fact, adopts them. And beyond that, ever since November 2009, an objective member of the public would know that Sergeant Hutchins has not received clemency. similar to the clemency vote that he received prior to November 2009.
Well, that's the question I wanted to ask. The statements had to do with clemency, which is an executive prerogative. How do we get into that? How is that UCI at all? How does that affect the judicial workings of the system? I, Ray Mabus, don't think these guys deserve clemency. Okay, that's your prerogative, Mr. Secretary, and for that matter, Mr. President. How's that UCI at all?
If Secretary Mabus had simply said, I'm not giving Sergeant Hutchins clemency and left it at that, there's no UCI there. There's no impact on the general public. That's not what Secretary Mabus did. And he didn't simply limit his statements to clemency. He went way beyond that, Your Honor. He went to the Associated Press, the Marine Corps Times, and the North Carolina Times, which serves Camp Pendleton, which is where the community authority was. He said, I've read the records of trial on these cases. I find what happened disconcerting. I couldn't believe they got the sentences they received. This is what happened. This is premeditated murder. That's not simply ruling against clemency, Your Honor. That's a senior executive, a senior leader of the Department of the Navy, making highly inappropriate statements, but more importantly, statements which directly impacted ongoing review by the military justice process.
Counsel, to ascertain what is or is not in the record in this case, do we have before us a statement by the Secretary of the Navy announcing a denial, a formal denial of clemency, and statements in support of that decision, or do we have commentary on a case by the Secretary of the Navy?
You know, we have both, Your Honor.
Where is the formal denial of clemency accompanied by a statement in the record in this case?
So the way that the Secretary's response, at least as indicated in the news articles which are attached to the record, is that he received an informal request from a congressman to review the case. And his response to that was done through the public and through the newspaper article.
I understand that. My question is, the Secretary has certain responsibilities under the UCMJ with respect to review of sentences. And in this case, did he exercise that responsibility, issue a decision, and issue an explanation in support of that decision? Or did he simply make commentary about an ongoing case?
I understand, Your Honor. He did not issue a formal denial. He simply issued commentary in which he said that he was denying the clemency request.
I have a question for the Chief Judge. I have another question I think it might be useful to get out at this time.
The government will have as much time as they need to address the questions from the bench.
This has to do with the remedy that you've requested, which is the dismissal with prejudice. As I understand the chronology that you've outlined, there was no unlawful influence alleged with respect to the action at trial. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And no unlawful action exercised with respect to the action of the convening authority.
That's correct. The convening authority's action.
Okay. So, assuming, for purposes of argument, that we agree with everything else you've said, why can't this case be retried?
Your Honor, it's been 3 years since Secretary Mabus has made his statements. Over these past 3 years, these statements have continued to be reproduced and disseminated, and there has been no remedial action from the Secretary of the Navy or any member of the Department of the Navy. Even if we went to retrial and Sergeant Hutchins won an acquittal, that wouldn't overcome what Secretary Mabus has already done, which has already branded him as having committed premeditated murder in the eyes of the Marine Corps and the public. An acquittal doesn't change that, Your Honor.
So you're looking for a remedy in the nature of a personal consequence rather than a remedy with respect to whether there could be a fair trial or not?
No, Your Honor. No, not at all.
Is there any question as to whether there could be a fair trial on a rehearing?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Because, for one, at this point, remedial action wouldn't even make a difference. But, for one, there's been no remedial action. Every single person that would participate in that trial, Your Honor, would continue to be subordinate to Secretary Mabus.
That's not necessarily the case. Why is this case limited to the Department of the Navy?
By operation of statute, Your Honor, this court's options would be to only return this case to the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, who could then remand it to a convening authority.
And could that not be remanded to any convening authority, including a convening authority who is not within the Department of the Navy?
Possibly, Your Honor, but the Judge Advocate General of the Navy would still be subordinate to the Secretary of the Navy when he made that decision. So any decision he made would still be tainted. This is similar to the case law where...
If it came from an order by this court for a remand to a convening authority not within the Department of the Navy, why would that be tainted?
So potentially that could get a convening authority outside of the Secretary of the Navy's chain of command.
There are a lot of them out there.
Yes, Your Honor. However, there is still the fact that a senior level official of this administration has made these statements, which have floated for several years, which certainly have the ability to impact any flag officer or any general officer who's looking to get promoted or move further in the Department of Defense. The fact that they don't fall underneath the Secretary of the Navy doesn't mean that this case still hasn't been made radioactive by the Secretary of the Navy, such that a convening authority at this point, be in the Army or the Coast Guard or whoever, deciding to agree to a pretrial agreement with no dismissal, no discharge, for example, or no confinement, wouldn't still think, you know what, this is the case that the Secretary of the Navy has made very public.
I understand your argument in that regard. Second question has to do with the operation of the board in this case. Do you agree with the government that the board's posture in this case was one of making a recommendation and not a decision?
Correct, Your Honor. Recommendation to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Okay. And if we were to find that that is, and I'm not asking you to concede, if we were to find that that is the only unlawful command influence exercised in this case upon the decision maker, would it be possible to have a differently constituted board or alternatively to refer it to a service outside the Navy for consideration to one of the other service secretaries?
Your Honor, per Article 74, it vests that clemency power with the secretary concerned.
I understand.
Therefore, I'm not sure this court would have
if the secretary concerned is disqualified, then what would preclude the Secretary of Defense, who my understanding is has all the authorities of all the secretaries of the services, from either taking that responsibility unto himself or herself or assigning it to another service secretary?
Possibly the Secretary of Defense could do that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
However, when a service member is convicted at a court-martial and receives a certain amount of confinement and a discharge, that entitles him to a suite of post-trial rights, Article 66, Article 67, ultimately. Article 74 is one of those rights. Not a right to receive clemency, but a right to receive consideration under Article 74. Article 74 discusses certain people who would be given that authority. If, as you say, it's simply devolved or raised to the Secretary of Defense, Sergeant Hutchins has still been deprived of consideration by under Article 74 by all those individuals, including the General Court Martial Committee authorities in his chain of command. As we discussed in this brief, clemency requests were submitted to them, which were denied.
No, I understand that. My question was, if we were to find that the only defect is with respect to the influence on the board, then is there a remedy available in terms of having the Secretary of Defense either take the responsibility or assigning it to another service secretary?
No, although that may be possible to do that, I would not agree that would
be. Why don't you address it on rebuttal, if you would?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Major Paul Everstein, along with Colonel Newman. I represent the United States. This Court should affirm the lower court's decision for two reasons. First, the Secretary's comments did not constitute unlawful command influence. They were merely explaining his decision on why he denied clemency, and they had no impact on these proceedings. And second, appellant initiated the conversation with NCIS about providing other statements, and he then voluntarily waived his rights before he provided a confession.
Why didn't you give him a lawyer when he asked for one?
Because the government's not required to, Your Honor. The government honored his request and that they ceased interrogation when he requested a lawyer.
What about the 72-hour rule in 305?
That's an administrative procedure, Your Honor. He might have got credit for that, for not getting a lawyer to represent him at the 305 hearing, but that has no impact on making it involuntary.
Well, how long can you leave an accused sitting incommunicado once they've requested a lawyer and not provide them with a lawyer? 2 weeks, a month, 2 months?
Totality of the circumstances, Your Honor. There are some circumstances where a short confinement, maybe an hour or two, could be involuntary, but there's also cases where you could have several months and even longer where it's not involuntary. It's totality of the circumstances.
Well, and why should we give credence to the military judge's finding that the investigator scrupulously honored his request to terminate the interview and to speak with an attorney? How do you scrupulously honor a request to speak to an attorney by keeping someone in a box for 7 days and not giving them an attorney? That's different than the Edwards question.
Yes,
it's a question about whether this is a clearly erroneous finding, et cetera.
They scrupulously honored that because what he was informed of on his rights advisement is that he had the right to the attorney to be with him during questioning. So they scrupulously honored that by not questioning him and not even attempting him to.
He doesn't have a right to consult with an attorney. That's the government's position.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it scrupulously honored his request to speak with an attorney.
By not interrogating him further.
He didn't ask to speak to an attorney if being interrogated. He asked to speak to an attorney.
Yes, he asked.
And they honored that right by giving him no access to a phone or any other means of communication and putting him in a cargo container.
Well,
I'm just getting at the scrupulous part. That to me, I mean, you can argue Edwards, but that I'm having a hard time figuring out why that's scrupulously honoring
the
request to speak to an attorney.
Yes, sir. What the judge meant is that they scrupulously honored that because they didn't even try to interrogate him again. So that's how you honor when a subject invokes their right to counsel during interrogation. You honor that right by not interrogating them further, not even trying to, unless they have their counsel present.
But you don't honor it by providing them with an attorney? I mean, if you're asking for an attorney, it would seem to me the next natural consequence would be the provision of an attorney.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's not been the case law of the Supreme Court. I mean, if we look.
Was there some operational reason why you couldn't get an attorney?
Well, it's not clear from the record, Your Honor. I mean, that part is not developed, but he was going back. It is clear that he was going back to the United States within a short period of time. So this isn't like he was going to be held at Camp Fallujah for months on end. I mean, everybody knew that they were being transported back to the United States, that they were flying out. The fact that he asked, is there still time for me to talk with NCIS that evening? They told him, well, we don't know, you're going back to the States. And they didn't talk to him until the next day. They didn't know if he was going to...
Yeah, okay, he's been sitting there for a week in this box. And then they show up and they say, we want to search this box. Yes or no? He has no lawyer. He doesn't know what the devil is going on. And as the government claims, he then reinitiated the interrogation. Isn't there just an eensy, weensy little bit of coercion here?
Well, there's coercion as
in the totality of the circumstances.
There's always coercion as far as from pretrial confinement. Anytime a person, the subject, is held in confinement, there is coercion. There's not unlawful coercion such that his rights waiver was not voluntary. He voluntarily waived his rights. In an important case on this...
Well, no, I'm talking about the fact that they now show up and say they want to search the thing.
Yes, Your Honor, which they're allowed to do.
Which?
I thought pretrial confinement was to ensure the individual is going to stick around, not to provide a small bit of coercion to get them to cooperate.
Your Honor, that's not the purpose for it, but I mean, we're just conceding that the Supreme Court has said, yes, that is inherently a coercive situation. That's why we give him a rights advisement. That's when we talk about that language that the appellant cited, going back from Miranda, that says, yes, incommunicado detention is inherently coercive. They're using that to say, this is why we have to advise somebody of their rights and tell them what their rights are so they can voluntarily waive those rights. That's why Article 31 exists. But the important case on point in this regard is Arizona versus Robertson, because there you had the person held in pretrial confinement or detention for 3 days, and the Supreme Court analyzed that case based on who initiated the conversation. In that case, the police went back and tried to interrogate him about an unrelated crime. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. But the issue was who initiated that conversation. There's no hint in the Supreme Court's decision that they were saying, well, 3 days, you know, that's an awful long time. At 6 days or at 7 days, we're going to presume that this statement is involuntary, and under no circumstances can you give a statement. They were looking at it as who initiated the conversation.
What if he had said, before I consent to this search, I want to talk to a lawyer?
That would not be a reinitiation of the conversation. So he invokes his right to counsel.
Well, would they have given him a lawyer?
Most likely not, Your Honor.
Most likely not. Okay.
So that, if he just says, I want a lawyer, that's not reinitiation of the conversation.
No, that's not the point I'm making.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
It would be a factor. If he asks for a lawyer again and is denied, that's certainly a factor that can
I realize that's not this case. But, yeah. Go ahead.
But the point is, under the totality of the circumstances, is his, when he waives his rights the next morning, is that voluntary? Now, it's important to consider what appellant is claiming now vice what he claimed at trial. If we look at the appellant's affidavit in the joint appendix on pages 1118 to 1124, at trial, they were fighting the initiation aspect. I mean, there was flat-out disagreement on this. Who initiated the conversation? The two NCIS agents said one thing, appellant said another thing. They fought about that at trial. The military judge found the appellant's affidavit was not credible, and he adopted the facts and made findings of fact and conclusions of law based on that. So his whole argument in his affidavit was, hey, I never would have waived my rights unless the NCIS agents brought up this subject about making another statement. It was their idea, and they brought me in. That's why I waived my rights. He's not making that argument in his affidavit that he's making now, that it was the confinement that was so coercive that after 7 days, I was just going stir crazy. I was willing to say anything. You know, it was the confinement that was making me waive my rights. That wasn't the argument that he made in trial. He was disagreeing or trying to posit a theory that he did not initiate the conversation. So there was disagreement on that. That was a factual matter that the military judge found at trial. So
are you arguing now that there's a waiver or a forfeiture of the involuntariness issue?
No, Your Honor, because it was raised in the motion. It was still raised, and if you look at the judge's conclusions of law, he addressed
so
that.
So what's the point, then?
That you would think if the appellant really felt coerced from the confinement, he would have said that at trial. That's not what he was saying at trial. If he really felt that way, if he felt, hey, it's the confinement, I've been in this camp for 7 days.
So you're asking us to make a factual finding on that? I'm not quite sure the import of the argument. If you're not making an argument on waiver of the involuntariness issue, what is it that you want us to do as a court in terms of our responsibility for looking at the facts and circumstances here?
What this court to do is to discount appellant's claim now that it's the confinement that was coercive and that's what led to his statement as being involuntary. That statement doesn't hold water based on what he was saying.
But we could still, without your conceding this, conclude that it's involuntary based upon the other facts. And sir, thank you.
Yes, sir. But if you look at what the military judge found in his conclusions of law, joint appendix on pages 385 and 386, I mean, his conclusions lay it out pretty clearly that appellant was the one, this was a free and voluntary act of the accused, and he went back. And it's also important to focus on the timeline. If this was a ploy to get appellant to provide another statement, the agent certainly would have taken his statement that evening when he said that he was interested in providing another statement.
Does it have to be a ploy for purposes of either involuntariness or for purposes of the waiver analysis? That is, if the appellant either felt compelled by the circumstances or was motivated by the questioning about the search to move into this area of discussion, does it matter whether it's a ploy or not? I understand that the ploy would be worse for the government, but is that a necessary matter for the defense to show on either one of those issues?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It's just totality of the circumstances. So, but it is important to consider what would happen if this court adopted Appellant's theory of making this presumed involuntary or his rights waiver being per se involuntary. That means that when he's asked, Special Agent Connolly, is it too late for me to provide a statement? Can I still tell my side of the story? Special Agent Connolly would have no choice but to say no. I'm not going to take your statement. You can't provide a statement.
Well, so the choice would be to ensure that he received counsel.
Yes, I'll give him that.
And then counsel could then decide how to advise his client, and his client can make a decision at that point.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, well, but even that case, I mean, the Supreme Court said that a short consultation with counsel is not enough to overcome the presumption. So still, you still wouldn't, just a short consultation would be enough. But yes, I mean, that would be their choice in this deployed environment in Camp Fallujah. Either get him an attorney or tell him, no, you can't provide a statement.
Now, with respect to the question of the request for consent to search, as the government has noted, that is a permissible question as a general matter. With respect to whether that then becomes a triggering event or not with respect to waiver, where would we look for case law precedent on that? I'm not asking by analogy or distinction, but is there any binding precedent on that particular question, or is that question one of first impression here?
We believe that would be an issue of first impression. However, we start from the presumption that there's lots of cases that say that the fruits of that search would be admissible.
Right.
So they're going back and asking him for consent to search is something that they're allowed to do. So if they're allowed to do that, then the question becomes, what happens when he says, hey, I want to give another statement? Are they prohibited from taking that statement simply because he had earlier invoked his right to counsel? We don't think that they should be. We think that should be a totality of circumstances, looking at, in this case, was his waiver voluntary? And if we do that, just looking at the judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law, there's no question that it was in this case.
Can I ask you two questions about the UCI issue? Thank you. So granted. First, the government argues that Article 37 does not apply. Is it also the government's view that facts that might otherwise amount to UCI could so impact the due process rights of an accused as to have the same effect? I'm not asking you to concede that's what occurred, but as a concept. So on one level, whether or not Article 37's text does or does not apply could be unimportant if the UCI otherwise impacted due process. Is that, I'm just saying, isn't that really what this is about, is from a constitutional standpoint, is due process values?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So it could implicate, depending on what type of UCI it was or who it was directed to, it could implicate other concerns. But what you would have in that situation, if you're analyzing due process rights or rights to a fair trial, rights to a fair trial by members that are not partial, you would look at Article 59A.
And that was not a trick question. It's just that the briefs were so focused on 37, I wanted to make sure there was not disagreement on the general concept rather than its application.
Yes, we're not arguing that the government would have carte blanche. He could say whatever he wanted just because it's...
And then as a second, my second question... The appellant argued that with respect to showing some evidence of influence with the judge advocate, he came up with a three-legged stool, which was subordinate, certification, and contrary to the advice of staff. Do you agree with the three legs of the stool, and if not, why not?
Well, we disagree that there was any unlawful command influence on the judge advocate general. And the reason being, the only decision that's at play here is his decision to certify the appeal to this court. So, first of all, if we look at the timeline, the secretary's comments are made in November of 2009. After that, the lower court reverses, overturns the finding and sentence. And the JAG's certification decision isn't until that following spring and summer. So it's not even remote or close in time to when the comments were made. But more importantly, the JAG certified relevant legal questions to this court. And the lower court's decision, if it would have been allowed to stand, would have required prejudice to be presumed in that case, would have impacted other cases, future cases where the lower court would improperly presume prejudice. So So there's no, I mean, the JAG certified relevant legal questions. Now, as far as your, the lady of the school about staff disagreement with his decision to certify, whether that was in the record is really unimportant, because I think what that shows kind of undercuts Appellant's theory that everybody was so influenced by the JAG that they were just towing the line. I mean, if staff are disagreeing...
First, do you accept that it's in the record or not?
It's not in the record, but we don't dispute that it occurred.
Shouldn't we rely on the record? It's not in the record, but you're saying it did occur?
Well, we're not sure what standard we're supposed to have. We don't have a factual dispute.
Okay.
There's no factual dispute as to the advice from TJAG's relevant subordinates and as to TJAG's decision. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But then you're saying, nonetheless, it indicates the lack of influence rather than the presence of influence.
Yes, if this court is going to consider it as such. Okay.
Now, you're not saying that a civilian official outside the confines of 37, other than his, a civilian official who's not subject to the code, you're not saying that he can never be the source of UCI?
No, Your Honor, if he was the convening authority, he could...
Are you saying that he can only do that if he was the convening authority?
Yes, Your Honor. That's
is UCI limited to the terms of Article 37? I thought you said it wasn't.
Well, no, Your Honor. There's other concepts that might apply, but
yeah.
UCI as a legal theory is limited.
This is a semantic point about whether you call it
due process or something else. I mean, but if the actions of an official, not himself subject to the code, adversely affected the workings of a court-martial, I'd call that UCI. Maybe you want to call it something else. You're saying that could exist?
It could, yes.
Okay, that's all I want to know.
Counsel, with respect to that due process UCI question, does it boil down to the question of who has the burden? Is that what's at stake here? That is, an unlawful command influence, if the evidence is raised, then it's the burden on the government to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. In a typical due process situation, we're dealing with unfair pretrial publicity, et cetera, the burden remains on the defense in that situation. Is that ultimately what's at stake here? Or is the government willing to say that the same burden would be on a service secretary statement?
No, Your Honor, the label, that's at stake, and then also the apparent.
So it's not simply the label, it's the consequence of the label that it has very major consequences for the way that these cases are tried. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, I had thought, and I may have missed something, that this issue was well settled during the early years of this court. There's a case, United States against Estrada, 7 CMA 635. And it recounts first the decision in Latrice, which said that statements by commanders cannot be brought into the courtroom. Then there's the case of Isbell, in which the court said, although we are here faced with a secretary rather than a command directive, the former emanating from the Secretary of the Service would be even more persuasive and bring more pressure to bear upon the members of the court than the latter type of directive. Then the court said it was against this sort of command influence that the code was initially directed, and the court specifically said, certainly the Congress announced its opposition to any such improper influences when it enacted Article 37. In that case in Estrada, they took a instruction from the Secretary of the Navy, and they said raising that in the courtroom constituted unlawful command influence under Article 37. My understanding of the way cases have been tried since then, whether it's the Cowley case or the Simpson case, the judges at trial and the judges on appeal have analyzed these cases under Article 37. So my question is, do we go back and overrule Estrada in all the cases that have relied on it? Is that what the government's asking us to do?
No, Your Honor, we wouldn't say overrule, but there is some language, say, for example, where UCI was analyzed, whether it was, came from commanders or from service secretaries, we would say simply a strict construction of Article 37, the secretary is not covered by that.
Then we have to overrule Estrada, because Estrada is based solely on a secretarial directive. Trial counsel got up and said, everybody in the room want to take notice of how we treat larceny in the Navy, and you all know what that SECNAV instruction says. And the court said, you can't do that. And they specifically cited Article 37.
Yes, sir. Well, again, that goes back to whether whether we call it Article 37.
But that has a big consequence. Under Article 37, if it's an Article 37 violation, then the government has to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which you've otherwise tried to show here. So I'm not asking you to concede that.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any other questions?
No.
Judge Stuckey, do you have a question?
No.
Any other questions up here? Do you wish to close or say anything? The appellant had additional time, so you allocated a full 7 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will not pass up the opportunity to remain silent.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe when we left off, Judge Stuckey had asked a question about Article 74 regarding the clemency authority.
I had asked a question as to how the exercise of an executive prerogative impacts on UCI.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the public announcement thereof.
So two answers. First of all, this wasn't just executive prerogative because that authority had been delegated down to multiple subordinates. Second,
it reposes in the ASN, doesn't it? In the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Personnel.
As well, per JAGMAN 0158, as well as any general court martial convening authority in the appellant's chain of command.
Mm-hmm. But the CA had already acted in this case, had he not?
He had, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
However, when the lower court reversed the case, Sergeant Hutchins went back to active duty and was therefore in a military chain of command, in which case, per JAGMAN 0158, under Article 74, the generals in his chain of command had clemency authority, and their exercise of that authority was in fact influenced by Secretary Mabus' statements in November 2009. Beyond that, what Secretary Mabus said wasn't just an exercise of executive authority. He went way above and beyond that, Your Honor, through his public statements and through his deliberate effort to send those out in newspaper articles. An exercise of clemency authority doesn't require the Secretary to say he's read all 8 records of trial, to say that he's unhappy with the results, to say I'm going to order the separation of anybody else that's on that.
Well, but isn't it a nice comment that he thought it was important enough to read the thing rather than just sign off on a staff summary sheet prepared by somebody else?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that the best response to that would be
he seems to take his responsibilities seriously in the area of executive clemency.
In this court's opinion, United States versus Simpson, this court indicated that when senior officials are seeking to comment on a case, which they may need to, they need to consider not only the needs of the moment, but the fairness for future proceedings. Secretary Mabus disregarded that admonition when he made his statements and he went on his media blitz.
Counsel, you're out of time. Are there any other questions on the bench? Would you like to briefly summarize in the same bonus 7 seconds?
Just to say, Your Honor, that we owe a duty to our Marines. We're going to put them through the military justice system, treat them with fairness and dignity, not just exploit them as political talking points. That's not who we are as a Marine Corps. That's not what we should expect from the CMJ. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties, and the court stands in recess until further order of the court. Thank you both.
Court stands in recess.